Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. What you just heard was Charles Mingus's Slop, off his frankly underrated 1960 follow-up to Mingus Dynasty, and the title is a reference to Mingus's ancestry because he was partially Chinese. We'll be joined by Jared Beckstedt-Cran, a bassist and educator currently based in Brooklyn, New York. A graduate of the University of Manitoba and Michigan State University, Jared's played with musicians such as Rodney Whittaker and Jocelyn Gould, and takes influence from Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, Duke Ellington, among many others. They're part of the New York-based collective Momentum, who are set to release their debut EP August 12th. Before the interview, we'll continue on with some solo piano from Thelonious Monk, playing Ask Me Now from the 1964 aptly named Solo Monk, then on to Canadian bassist Mike Downs' Momentum, no relation, off his 2017 album Root Structure, then straight to the legendary 1993 hip-hop crossover album Jazzmatazz Volume 1 by Guru, featuring all live musicians. They all did it right in the studio. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm lounging. I got my man Donald Byrd on the horn. I want to give a big shout out to my little man Nico. He's 2 years old. He's away visiting his grandma's, but I miss him dearly. If I rhyme this, you will find this situation shall advance. You could take a glance or dance. Elevated lyrics to arouse a crowd. Now tell me who's the man to show you how. Many legacies of brothers who get busy. And I do it fluid till the suckers get dizzy. Saying peace to the Blackbirds, 125th Street. And check the flow that's unique. For lounging, lounging, lounging. Mellow out and just lounging. Lounging, lounging. Mellow out and just lounging. Can't refuse this, never lose this. It's a choicest, cause my voice is the smoothest. Dominating to your voice, cause I've been around doing work. And so have tons of other jerk. Donald Byrd word on the track, quite exact. Giving you the format, Jack. See, we gotta pave the way and display how to lounging. Just lounging. Mellow out and just lounging. Lounging, lounging, lounging. Mellow out. I just lounge and
so I the whole record market. Today it outsells classical music.
Peace to the pioneers, but I gotta try and clear my throat. Check out what I wrote. You can't tap into this unless you know the roots. Words shoot like life absolute for real. So now you got to know the deal. For lounging, lounging, just lounging. Mellow out and just lounging. Lounging, lounging. Mellow out, check it out. And lounging, lounging. Lounging, lounging, mellow out, and just lounging, 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 east to Brooklyn where I live, where I live. Realistic, kind of mystic, when I kick this, you should witness the slickness of the horn player and the dope rhyme sayer, quite emotional and inspirational, philosophical and yes, very logical, teaching you the method for lounging, lounging. Everybody knows they have times when they want to just lay back, kick their feet up, you know, listen to some good music, and just lounge, lounge. That's right. I said lounge, I said lounge.
Some instrumental tracks to everything we do, because when rap started with what they did was, which was so ingenious, was to create a whole form of urban style music from just two turntables and two records.
Joining us is Jared Beckstead, a bassist and educator currently based in Brooklyn, New York. A graduate of U of M and Michigan State University, Jared's played with musicians such as Roddy Whittaker and Jocelyn Gould, and takes influence from Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, and Duke Ellington, among many others. They're part of the New York-based collective Momentum, who are set to release their debut EP this summer. How are you doing, Jared?
I'm good, Gareth. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, I guess the first question is, what can you tell me about your group, Momentum?
Well, Momentum is a group that I joined officially in the spring, but I started playing with them in the fall when I got here. It was started by this vibraphonist, Grady Tesh, who's been based in New York for the past almost 8 years, I guess. We actually met a long time ago at a jazz camp in Rochester, New York. So we reconnected when I got here and started playing and decided to record an EP in the spring. So we just finished recording and that's coming out in the summer. The music is really cool. It's different than a lot of music that I've played in the past, but it definitely draws influence from a lot of places. You know, jazz, R&B, soul, funk, classical music. It's the thing that I love about being a part of Momentum is that it really is a collective. We all offer like equal input into the tunes and the arrangements, the recording process, the performance process. I feel very much like a part of it, and I feel like there's a piece of me in all the tunes, and all of our influences kind of like shine through in the music. So I'm pretty excited about it. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. The single that you showed me, it was like kind of got like a really like collaborative vibe from like the tune and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of like different styles within that one track, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. I think I caught like a jungle beat at one point. I was like, oh,
yeah, we were in a rehearsal and, Grady has a lot of ideas and energy, which is really great. And we had more or less an arrangement put together. And he was like, man, this tune really needs a breakbeat section. And we were like, you know what? It does. So we went with it and it ended up being really cool. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. What's the name of your EP?
That's a good question. It doesn't have a name yet, but it'll likely be named after one of the singles.
Nice.
Yeah.
Like yeah. Name all of it all by itself. Doesn't have a name yet, but it will be.
It doesn't have a name yet, but it will be. It could just be called Momentum. We'll see.
Yeah. Speaking of New York City, like how did you find the transition period from that to Winnipeg? Like how do you like learn to adapt to the scene there?
Well, oh, there goes the train. Yeah. Like I was saying, I live right next to a train. Might get a little loud. Well, I actually didn't transition directly. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
I didn't transition directly from Winnipeg to New York. I did my graduate studies at Michigan State University in Lansing. So I was in Michigan for 2 years. The pandemic hit kind of right in the middle of my degree. So I'd say one of the biggest hurdles in the transition has just been, you know, the state of the world. It's really... Everything is pretty uncertain right now. The cost of living here is going up considerably all the time. So it has been, you know, tough, like I'm not gonna lie. Just, you know, financially it's tough. But the thing about New York that's so great, and this has been coming up in conversation with a lot of people here recently, is just like, I mean, the reason you move here is because there's so much going on and there's so many people here, right? You know, on any given night, like I'll have trouble deciding which thing to go to. You know, I'll be like, oh man, I want to see my friend at this place, but also this person's playing here, and like maybe I can like leave halfway through this and catch all this. So that's really like what's great about being here, is being surrounded by so much music all the time and so many different styles of music. You know what I mean? And so many different approaches to, you know, the word genre is like, you know, there's problems with that. Maybe we can get into that, but there's so many different approaches in each scene, I guess is a better word. And just so many things happening. So it's an exciting place to be, meeting new people all the time, and really getting to, you know, it's a place where you learn more about yourself and what kind of music you like and what kind of music you want to play and what kind of people you want to collaborate with. So that's been a really big part of the transition and the journey here is learning about myself, because I've been in school for, you know, a long time, which is great. I learned a lot in school. But when you're in school and you're, you know, under the guidance of your professors and your peers, and you're kind of being, I don't want to say steered in a certain direction, but I do think it's good if a program has a direction. and a goal for its students. So you kind of, you're more singularly focused in school, you know, you're trying to get better at maybe a specific style of music or a specific way of playing. And so that's like a great incubation period. But once you're out and you come to a place like New York, you know, any big city, any city really, it's a really great opportunity to learn more about your musical identity. So that's kind of been, that's been the vibe, you know?
Cool. Yeah. New York seems like one of those places where it's like there's just a huge melting pot. You can just take so many influences from so many different things. Mm-hmm. Just kind of build your musical identity along the way. And like as a bassist, that must be really interesting for you, because like you can pick up on a ton of genres and like play in a bunch of different settings. So how's that mm-hmm. like?
I do feel fortunate as a bassist, because you know people always need bass players. So I do end up playing, you know, like I was saying with this Momentum EP, I end up playing and operating in a lot of different styles and a lot of different headspaces, and that's part of what I think. Made me gravitate towards the instrument, and the, I guess you could say the profession of bass playing is, a lot of it is being sensitive to what people want musically and trying to provide that, you know? So, you know, playing with all these different people, playing different styles of music, you know, even when I was in Winnipeg, I was playing Brazilian music, I was playing Afro-Cuban music, I was playing swing, like I was, you know, and adjusting to those different, stylistic situations and really like trying to key into what the leader or what the band wants from you as a bassist, as a musician, as a member of the group is part of what makes music fun for me. You know, I like doing a good day's work of music, you know, making the music sound good and doing what I can to serve the music. So it's definitely being here is a good opportunity to do that in as many different ways as I can with as many different people.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, going off of that, I think like it said in your bio that your personal conception of music comes from like a confluence of your Haitian heritage, eclectic upbringing, and your desire to make people dance.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah. Can you elaborate a bit of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think from day one, the thing that drew me to music was dancing. You know, when you're like really little. Something I noticed, like I've bussed a couple times in New York, especially when I first got here. And something that I noticed was that, you know, when you're playing something the word jazz is like, so I'm going to say swing. When you're swinging, I've realized that it's a universal feeling, although it comes from like a very particular place, and time and culture and lineage. When you're swinging on the sidewalk, the people who start dancing and don't want to leave, they're always kids. You know, there's like this thing like where they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. What is this? I just want to dance. And then their parents are like, come on, we got to go. And I'm like, oh, come on. Like, let's hang out. So I think like for me as a kid, I had that like joyful connection to the way music made me want to move my body. You know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a household where dancing was, you know, not just okay, but it was encouraged. You know, my mom and I, you know, we put on records and we danced together. And so I always had this sort of like physical connection to the music. You know, when I play bass, when I hear music, I want to, you know, there's not all the time, right? Like there's music that isn't for the purpose of dancing, but like I love hearing music that makes me want to dance. So when it's my turn and I'm in the position where I'm playing the music, that's the feeling that I want to give to people. You know, I want to play the bass or whatever instrument I'm playing in a way that makes them want to move their body, because that's the first joy that connected me to the music. Yeah. So as far as making people want to dance, that's where it comes from. It's that childhood, you know, thing.
And like everyone can relate to that, because like it's internal. Everyone knows about like rhythm without even telling you about it. Mm-hmm. So you can make people like swing or like just dance. Like you're already there.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess like going off like that dance thing. I guess like talking about when you're saying like as a bassist. You did like a graduate presentation on like Monk's Bassist for your graduation recital. Like what appeals mm-hmm. What appeals to you like specifically about like those players and like Monk's music?
it goes back to what we were just talking about that feeling of dance. I think when I was, I think the first time I really heard Monk was when I was maybe 11 or 12. You know, I had it on my MP3 player, my iPod or whatever. I had a couple albums like, you know, Duke Ellington, John Coltrane, and Monk's Dream. And the thing that drew me to it was the bounce. You know what I'm saying? Monk's discography, Monk's recorded history it's so danceable. You know, there's so much in it that people focus on harmonically and melodically, improvisationally. But the thread that I feel, you know, runs through it is the feeling of it. It's that, like, that sort of somewhere between stride, swing, bebop, sort of like bounce, that swing. And, you know, when I sort of like rediscovered, here comes the train again, when I sort of like rediscovered that music at the age of 18, 19, where was I going with this? Oh, yeah. The thing that really struck me was that, you know, Thelonious Monk, like, here is a person who has, as a solo artist, that has had so many different iterations of his band, you know, throughout his career. But the band's always managed to have this particular thing, you know, that is unique to those groups, unique to those groups led by Thelonious Monk, and it's that feeling, that bounce. And so I really started to become obsessed with, like, those different iterations, like, who's playing bass, you know, is it Butch Warren, is it Larry Gales, is it Wilbur Ware, like, how does it sound different, how does it sound the same, you know, Charlie Rouse, how does he sound on a Monk record, how does he sound on his own record, what's different, what is that feeling, that language, that rhythmic sort of, like, vibration that Monk is bringing out of all those musicians, and that's something that I just became, like, so enamored with, and I was fortunate enough to, you know, get to study it, like, you know, in the situation where I had to do a academic presentation about something, I was fortunate enough to do it on something I loved, which was examining three of Monk's bass players, and John Orr, Butch Warren, and Larry Gales, and examining, like, what did they have in common playing in that band, what was slightly different, to get a clearer picture of, like, what it is that made Monk's bands Monk's bands. You know what I'm saying? Like, what did he, I don't know if he ever explicitly asked people to play the way they did. I'm sure he was very selective about who he played with and was looking for a certain thing. But I'm sure that being in that group brought out certain, you know, musical sensibilities in people, you know, like, especially the rhythmic feeling of it, you know?
Definitely, yeah. And, like, as a pianist, I guess Monk kind of appeals to me in a slightly different way, like, his notes and, like, his rhythm, there's a kind of rhythm to, like, his intentionality, like, how he plays the notes.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that kind of, like, speaks to me as well. Mm-hmm. It's like saying what you're talking about, like, the bassist as well. It's just, like, it's that same kind of bounce, like, with his, like, you can, like, analyze it all you want with like the five note, like, the five rhythm thing, and, like, but it's kind of an internal thing. You just know.
Yeah, you just gotta hear it, and then you're like, oh yeah, that thing.
That's Monk.
That's Monk.
You also studied with Rodney Whitaker at MSU, so, like, what was that like as an experience?
So great. You know, Rodney Whitaker is just one of the greatest.
Oh, I think you froze.
Oh, it froze for a second. Am I back?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yep. Greatest city in the world, worst internet. silly. But yeah, going back to Rodney Whitaker, he's just such a great educator, such an empathetic person, such a caring individual. Obviously, such an amazing musician and bass player. Who's played with, you know, some of the greatest musicians ever. So just, like, a wealth of knowledge. But I think the thing that really stuck out to me about Rodney Whitaker and the reason that I wanted to study with him was how much care he put into each individual student, you know. He has more or less, you know, a curriculum that he teaches to all the bass players. You know, all the bass players, they got to learn some Oscar Pettiford, they got to learn some Ray Brown, they got to learn some Paul Chambers, you know, which is good. But he really, no matter what the interests of each student are, you know, whether that student is equally interested in Oscar Pettiford and in Sid Vicious, you know, he recognizes that and he fosters that and he respects that in each student. You know, he doesn't try to turn students into something they're not. He tries to show them the base lineage that he loves and hopes that they learn something out of that and hopes that they can contribute something out of that. So I think one of the greatest things about him as an educator, yeah, is that he has that empathy for each individual student, and that makes it such a joy and a wonder to study with him, because you feel like an individual and not just a student in a program. Yeah, I could talk about Roddy Whitaker all day. One of my favorite things that he told me, that I think is a good lesson for anyone in just how to foster like a good culture in jazz music is, you know, I came to him one time frustrated about the way that it was going in this rhythm section I was playing with the drummer. We couldn't connect rhythmically, and we started talking about, you know, those situations where, you know, you might go to a jam session, I'm sure this has happened to you before, and you get up there and, you know, you realize that one of the rhythm section players has a lot less experience than the other ones. And in those situations, a lot of the times, more experienced musicians will, you know, they'll be like, no, it's here, you know, like, this is the tempo. And that's, you know, that's fine. That's, you know, like you care about the tempo. I care about the tempo too. But I asked Prof. Whitaker, I said, you know, what do you do in this situation? And he said, nobody ever swung harder because you frowned at them. You know what I'm saying? He said, nowadays, man, when the drummer isn't swinging, I just smile. You know? And it's true. Like, if you stare down the drummer and you start stomping your foot, that doesn't make people feel like happy to play music. That doesn't make people feel safe, you know? And we, you know, this music is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be joyful. Obviously, like, it can communicate a lot of other things than those emotions, and it does. It communicates the whole spectrum of emotion. But when you're in those situations at a jam session, it doesn't do anyone good to vibe someone out and embarrass them on stage, you know? So yeah, that was a lesson that is really important to me. I think about that all the time, you know, because I don't want to alienate anyone from the music. You know what I mean? This music it brings me so much joy, and it's so special to me. I don't want to scare anyone away from it. You know what I'm saying? And it's true. When you smile at someone, they swing better. You know? So.
Yeah. Definitely agree with that. It's like, you're just frowning at somebody, like, all like, hey, you gotta get the time right. It's like, all right, I don't get it. Like, what are you on about? Like,
yeah.
That actually raises a good point into my next question. Like, since you, I saw that you also like taught like courses at like MSU for like beginning jazz improvisation. Mm-hmm. So how did you manage to like kind of convey like that kind of like sense of improv without kind of like scaring people away, or like kind of easing them into the process of, I guess, like improv in general?
Well, I was fortunate at MSU because the group of students I was working with were all very talented, very hardworking, very kind, supportive individuals who all, you know, wanted to be there. It was tough because we were online. I was teaching the course through Zoom. You know, so that has its own challenges. But everyone was there because they loved the music. So in a sense, that made my job easier. But my approach to teaching jazz improvisation at that level, you know, at the first year undergraduate level, was a lot of listening. You know, of course we did, there was a theory component, because, you know, theory is important, not necessarily for the purposes of playing the music, but for under understanding it in a way that you can communicate it to other people. You know, I think theory is a tool that we can use to communicate. You know, when I say D7 sharp 11, you know that what that is. You know what I mean? So when we're in the studio, we're on a gig, it's like, oh, can we play D7 sharp 11 in bar 3 instead of, you know, whatever was there before? It's useful in that sense, you know, or talking about recordings. You know, I love this line that Charlie Parker plays over the D7 sharp 11, you know, stuff like that. But in my approach to the teaching a jazz improvisation course, I wanted the centerpiece to be the recordings, you know, and the repertoire. So we had you know, a tune list, a general tune list that all the Michigan State University first years learn. And each class was looking at one of those tunes and listening to, you know, as many contrasting recordings as we had time for, and seeing kind of what we're talking about with Monk, like what are the common threads? You know what I mean? What, you know, when you look at a song like Take the A Train, like what do people play on that dominant two chord? You know what I mean? What does everyone play there? You know, if we listen to Duke Ellington, we hear a lot of whole tone, you know? So that tells us how we can play on that tune. We learned how to play on that tune from the recording instead of taking a lead sheet and saying, okay, what are the scales that go over these chords? That's, you know, a good skill to have too, but I think it's really important to look at the recordings and say, what are the common threads, you know? Because that's how the language builds. That's how you communicate with other people. When you're on the bandstand playing Take the A Train, you're likely playing with a bunch of people who have heard, you know, at least several recordings of Take the A Train. So that's what they're drawing from. And if that's what they're drawing from and that's what you're drawing from, you might have a common recording, and suddenly you have common ground, you have common language, and you can communicate. So in that improvisation class, it was really about building that habit with the students of when you're going through the repertoire, checking out the recordings, and learning how to play over tunes through the recordings.
Yeah. What you're saying, like what you were saying about the D7 sharp 11, you can also apply that to like players as well. Like, for example, like as a bassist, someone could go up to you in the bandstand and say like, oh, I want you to play like Ray Brown on We Get Requests. And you'd be like, oh yeah, I know that record.
And you just, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's important in other recordings. Like, or even, you know, if it's not explicitly mentioned, you know, if the piano player starts playing like Oscar Peterson on We Get Requests, then I might turn up the Ray Brown, you know, to make it sound good. So yeah, the recordings are important.
Definitely. Yeah, I guess as like a large pivot into like a thing, I guess since you've had like so much experience like living in New York City and like gigging and studying at like U of M and like Michigan State, I was wondering, do you have any advice for navigating the fraught landscape of the post-graduation life?
Do you have any? I need some too. I get the importance of the question, because it is hard. Leaving school, because I feel like by the time you finish school, you're just kind of getting used to it. You know, you're like, okay, I get this. And then, oh, dang, I graduated. And then you have to, you know, life outside of school is pretty different. So I'd say I'm still figuring it out, you know, especially in this, I'm going to say post-pandemic, but we all know that we're still in a pandemic. But especially in this post-pandemic, maybe I should say post-lockdown sort of,
neo-pandemic.
Neo-pandemic. In this neo-pandemic, it's especially hard for people in our position who have graduated recently, because we're not only adjusting to a different way of our day-to-day living, but the world is changing so fast and has changed so fast in the past couple years. And it can lead to this feeling of instability, which is what myself and a lot of people I know are feeling right now. So I'd say post-graduation, I think it's important. I think the best thing you can do for yourself, that I'm learning to do for myself, is to be kind to myself and realize that, you know, this is a process. This is a transition time. It's not going to be perfect. it's probably not going to be easy. It is going to be uncomfortable. And to just be okay when you have those days where, you know, you're not feeling the greatest, you're not feeling like yourself, because it's just a hard time to be a human right now. And especially it's a hard time to be a human who just graduated from a music program, you know? But I think the bright side of being someone who graduated recently is that you are, you know, kind of like I was saying at the beginning of our talk, you are in a time where you're discovering a lot about yourself, and that can be like a really special process. You know what I mean? Because since you're outside of school and you're operating on your own, you really have time to sit and think and say, like, you know, who am I? What do I like to do? For us specifically as musicians, what kind of music do I like to play? What kind of music do I like to listen to? You know, you're finally in a place where, you know, it's great to have someone telling you, okay, you this week you're learning this solo, you know? But when you're out of school, it's a cool opportunity to be like, what solo do I want to learn this week or this month, you know? It might not be something that you ever first saw yourself learning, you know, when you were in school. And that's really special, is to like realize those parts of you, you know. I'm kind of, having been out of school for, I guess it's been a year now, there's been periods where I've sort of like, you know, I used to be like a huge metalhead when I was like a pre-teenager. And so I was like, what does that music sound like? And checking out again, I'm like, oh yeah, I really like this, you know. Just like realizing that those things are still a part of me, they're still in there, and allowing those influences to coexist with the new ones, you know. So yeah, be kind to yourself and just explore, you know. I think is, you know, that would be my advice. So far, I've only been out of school for a year, so I'm still figuring out myself.
Yeah. Does this mean that you're gonna have? There's gonna be a Degent, Jared Bexjed bass album on the horizon.
We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Going off that, do you have any future gigs or any future plans coming up? Do you have any future posts planned for the Foodies Jared account? You haven't posted since 2019. The world needs to know, Jared, about the New York culinary scene.
The tragic thing about Food Eats Jared is that I've been locked out of that account. I no longer have access. Instagram has not responded to my numerous requests for access. So I'm planning on either making a new one or incorporating Food Eats Jared into my music account. I do still love to cook and I love to eat, and you know, food is like my second love. So keep your eyes peeled. as far as music goes, with Momentum this summer in early July, we're going to be having our EP release show. At the end of June, I'm going to be doing a solo double bass show here in the city, which I'm excited for. I'm, you know, during the pandemic when we had no one to play with, I ended up shedding, for the first time, you know, some solo bass repertoire, which was really fun, like taking tunes that I really love or tunes that I wrote, and kind of like, it was almost like a puzzle, you know, trying to figure out how I could play the melody and the harmony to a song on one instrument, especially on the double bass, which has really interesting physical limitations. So that, yeah, I'm excited to play some of that music. And, you know, I'm just playing around, playing at hotels, playing at sessions. But those are the two big things. We got that EP release in July and this solo bass show coming up. So, yeah, that's what's going on.
Nice. Thanks to Jared Bexjed for being here on the show. You'll be able to hear Momentum's EP on August 12th. Before the interview, you heard Charles Mingus' Slop from Mingus Dynasty, Thelonious Monk playing Ask Me Now from Solo Monk, Mike Downs' Momentum from Root Structure, and Loungin' from Jazzmatazz Volume 1 by Guru. We'll finish off with a solo bass piece from Miroslav Vitus called Matter and Spirit from his 1986 album Emergence, and with Oliver Jones and Charlie Biddle playing the classic All the Things You Are from the 1983 Festival International de Jazz de Montreal. This is Canadiana Suite signing off. Thank you.